Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The enthusiasm that people had among moderates to liberals for Mary Peltola was palpable.
What Mary Peltola's special election win could mean for the November race to come. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson shares plans for a winter homeless shelter.
We are prime and ready to have conversations with the administration about their ideas. We were just waiting for them to come to us with those ideas.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Democrat Mary Peltola clinched a historic victory Wednesday against Trump-backed Republican Sarah Palin to fill Alaska's lone congressional seat. Her win sets the stage for a contentious next few months, though, as she, Palin, and Republican Nick Begich restart their campaigns, this time competing for a full 2-year term that begins in January. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George spoke to 2 political analysts for their thoughts on Peltola's win and what it means for the November general election.
Mary Peltola flipped a historically Republican seat for U.S. House on Wednesday. She will also be the first Alaska Native person to serve in Congress, and she won with the smallest fundraising budget of the 3 final candidates in the race. Political consultant Jim Lotzfeld says there are a number of reasons why she won, but a big one was excitement supporters felt for a progressive candidate focused on local issues.
As a guy who lives in Alaska, the enthusiasm that people had among moderates to liberals for Mary Peltola was palpable. Her ethnicity, but that she's nice and she's got this great track record and she's got these great retail political skills.
Lotzfeld currently works for the Super PAC Alaskans for Lisa, supporting Lisa Murkowski's Senate reelection bid. He also calls the election an indictment of Republican Sarah Palin. He says Palin's political capital in Alaska has waned in the last decade since she resigned as governor and later began to focus on her national celebrity.
Sarah Palin has really soiled her welcome with Alaskans. And there is just a supermajority of Alaskans that are done with her.
Lotzfeld points to her few campaign appearances and avoidance of the press this election cycle. Then there's the question of how Republican Nick Begich, who finished 3rd, influenced the outcome of the race. In the ranked choice election, Begich was eliminated 1st. Just over half his voters ranked Palin as their 2nd choice. Nearly a 3rd picked Peltola 2nd. And the remaining 21% either left their 2nd choice empty or chose a write-in candidate. Attorney Scott Kendall, who is also currently working for Alaskans for Lisa, says given the bruising campaigns Palin and Begich ran this cycle, it makes sense that Begich voters chose not to peel off for Palin in higher numbers. He says it likely cost Palin a victory.
I go back to the very, very negative campaign Nick Begich ran. It's very tough to, spend 3 months demonizing a person and then expect your supporters en masse to support that person. I think if there's a single factor, it was Nick Begich's campaign tactics.
If the 2 Republican candidates hope to turn things around for November, Kendall argues that they'll need to tone down the animosity that's keeping their supporters from ranking one another 2nd. Already, it's looking unlikely that will happen. Talking to reporters after results came out Wednesday, Palin said she was waiting to see if Begich was, quote, man enough to drop out of the race to ensure a Republican win. Begich, meanwhile, attempted to gain support in a statement late Wednesday, saying Palin could not win, quote, because her unfavorability rating is so high. Kendall says even if Begich beats Palin and comes in second in the general election, it's unlikely he'd win a ranked choice runoff against Peltola.
There is no question in my mind that if he overtakes her employing the same tactics that he's used to date, there will be an enormous bleed off, maybe even more bleed off than we just saw, of votes for Palin that either don't rank or go to Peltola. Because civility matters.
Meanwhile, Peltola's path to a November victory is by no means assured, but Lotsveld says getting to campaign as the incumbent is a huge boost, both in name recognition and in fundraising.
Now she's a national figure. She just, you know, knocked off the number one Donald Trump surrogate in the universe, Sarah Palin. So will they capitalize on it and have, you know, instead of running a campaign that was spending, you know, a couple $100,000, will they now be sitting on $20 million?
Peltola is expected to be sworn into office later this month. The general election for the full U.S. House term is November 8th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson has announced his plan for sheltering the city's homeless population during the winter. The announcement comes after weeks of frustration from the Anchorage Assembly that the Bronson administration had no plan as winter approaches. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports.
Since Mayor Bronson shuttered the Sullivan Arena mass shelter at the end of June, a big question has lingered. Where will homeless residents go in the winter? For now, many have turned to the Centennial Park Campground, which became a makeshift homeless camp after the mayor began waiving camping fees and bused individuals to the site this summer. Frustrated assembly members moved to create a community task force last month to come up with a winter sheltering plan in the absence of one from Bronson. But now, Bronson's team says it has a path forward. After saying they'd have a plan by the end of August, Bronson officials released their written four-tiered plan on Wednesday night. Midtown Anchorage Assemblymember Felix Rivera, who chairs the Assembly's Committee on Housing and Homelessness, says he's relieved.
We are prime and ready to have conversations with the administration about their ideas. And, you know, we were just waiting for them to come to us with those ideas. So now that they have, I'm hoping to work in a very collaborative manner with them.
In a press release, Bronson officials said they consulted with Rivera before releasing their plan, though Rivera says that didn't happen. The plan describes a four-pronged approach to sheltering. It'll start with using up to 20 of what it describes as portable, self-contained buildings. If you've ever had to teach or learn in a portable classroom, they look like that. Officials say each building could house between 10 and 12 people. The plan does not say where the buildings would go. The administration says it's getting the buildings for free from a community partner. In an email response to questions, Bronson officials didn't specify who the community partner is, though Rivera speculates they could be coming from faith-based nonprofit Revive Alaska. The group had proposed a housing complex in South Anchorage using temporary structures they'd obtained from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
That apparently fell through due to community opposition. My, again, speculation is that Revive it turned those portable buildings over to the administration for use as emergency shelter.
Other parts of the plan include providing grants to community nonprofits and churches to house people, as well as extending operations at the non-congregate shelter at the Aviator Hotel downtown to the end of the year. Bronson officials say they anticipate the city's new shelter and navigation center in East Anchorage will be able to start housing people on November 21st before it's fully constructed in February. Another part of the plan includes using the Spinard and Fairview Recreation Centers as shelters, though officials with the mayor's office say that plan is an emergency option if the portable buildings plan falls through. Rivera agrees that using the rec center should be a last resort and is hopeful that the mayor will continue working with the emergency shelter task force.
There might be some ideas in the administration's plan that don't work or that won't pass muster, and that's okay. We have a task force that can help fill those gaps. And so in the end, I feel confident if we can work together, that we can come up with solutions.
Bronson officials anticipate that most of the sheltering options will become available in October. The next step is a proposed code change to allow for the portable buildings, which the administration says it will bring forward during the Assembly's next meeting on September 13th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Coming up, during a nationwide shortage, school bus drivers in Anchorage are more important than ever.
It's very touching because they're like, you know, I've heard the need and I just feel like I want to do my part.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Alaska's court system is launching an eviction diversion program aimed at resolving disputes between landlords and tenants before they end up in court. The grant-funded initiative will provide landlords and tenants with information on things like legal assistance, mediation, financial counseling, and rental assistance. The goal is to help reach an agreement both sides are satisfied with, and for people to avoid spending time and money going to court to plead their case in front of a judge. David Nesbitt with the state's 3rd Judicial District in Anchorage is one of those judges. Nesbitt says, like a lot of things, the COVID-19 pandemic has changed the nature of how eviction proceedings are working, and not for the better. But Nesbitt also says there's always the constraint of not having enough time in court to reach agreements. Sitting in an Anchorage courtroom recently, he says that's a problem he thinks an eviction diversion program could help alleviate.
The court's very mindful of what kind of impact this has on the general community, and this often affects some of the most vulnerable members of our community. And I would say that the Alaska court system is among the front runners in the nation for providing a lot of resources to people. And so pre-COVID, when a lot of people would come to the courtroom, they'd be able to negotiate a lot of these cases in the hallways, in the side gallery and so on. Especially now when far more people are on the phone, that kind of communication does not occur as often. And so we're doing a lot of that on the bench. This program not only provides free legal advice, it also provides a structured environment for people to get together and discuss their case. And very often they can reach agreements outside of court.
But would an eviction diversion program really, and I think this is where people are going to go with this, would it really help keep people in their homes?
It could. Absolutely, it could. In a lot of cases, we reach agreements where the landlord, given the opportunity and facing what's going on in the case, the landlord will allow the tenant an additional opportunity to get current on their rent. Just that little reprieve will often give people a chance to get back on their feet, chance to get their first paycheck from their new job. It allows people to stay in their residences, and it makes a huge difference. And ultimately, it's better for the landlord, too, to have stable housing and stable tenancy.
There was that one particular case where I think you even said at one point, you know, you were going to take off your judge's hat and put on your mediator's hat. You really did seem to be mediating a dispute there that had a lot of emotional components to it, but really kind of boiled down to like, how much money are you going to give me when, right? And I guess it sounds like what you're saying is that an eviction diversion program would allow more time for that sort of mediation where you don't have these constraints where you've got to get this number of cases done in a certain amount of time, right?
Precisely. The landlord-tenant relationship is a very close relationship in many cases, and it often involves a lot of background information that has to do with the relationship of the parties, disagreements, arguments, fights. It's a relationship, and sometimes they don't work out. And a lot of times parties come into the courtroom and they want to talk about those relationships, the hardships, the background information. All of that is very compelling for the court, but it doesn't really weigh a lot of times in the decision whether to go forward with the eviction, whether to grant the judgment in the writ. It really comes down to whether the landlord has satisfied the elements of the statute. A diversion program will allow people to air their grievances probably a lot more satisfactorily than they would in court, because the court often doesn't have the time to explore those different types of grievances. It really comes down to whether the statute's been met, whether it's been satisfied.
What's it like when either on the phone or, you know, face to face, you have to tell a tenant, you know, sorry, the boxes are all checked. This is following the statute. And,
you know, unfortunately, a cop's going to show up at your door and move you out. What's that like?
I think it's very, very difficult for the court. I think in many circumstances, you know, we're human. We recognize the human toll that this takes on people. We are obligated to follow the law. And a lot of times we follow the law knowing that our decisions are going to have a dramatic effect on one side or the other. And so when people come in, they're often very upset. They are often, you know, a lot of bad things have happened to them. And then we're going to add one more on top of that. I would say if you talk to any judge, they're very, very mindful of the significance of their decisions and how it affects people's lives. And it's very, very difficult. I find it very challenging because we have a heart. We care. We don't want, you know, to inflict suffering on other people. But as part of our job, we're obligated to follow the law, and we have to follow the law. And if that's what the law dictates, then we do it. And that's part of our job.
That was District Court Judge David Nesbitt. School bus drivers are an essential part of a student's day. They deal with busy roads and distracted drivers, all with dozens of kids in tow. Districts around the state are trying to figure out what it takes to attract more drivers amid a nationwide shortage. To get an inside look, Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas rode along with an Anchorage school bus driver and has this story.
Every weekday morning around 6:30 a.m., Michael Herzog inspects a school bus at the Anchorage School District's transportation depot. He checks the lights and the tread on the tires. Then he gets into the driver's seat to test the brakes.
This is just making sure that if an emergency happened, we lost brake pressure, that our brakes would turn on.
Herzog is one of more than 150 drivers on staff in the Anchorage School District, which is facing an ongoing driver shortage. Herzog applied after retiring from a retail job. He has three kids who all went through the district, and he says he's a big believer in public education.
I felt like I wanted to give something back to the community that was part of it. I felt like I wasn't quite ready to completely exit the work thing and the schedule of that. I knew I wanted to do something with kids.
Herzog started driving in winter 2021, when Anchorage students went back to school in person for the first time since the pandemic started. On this Tuesday morning, Herzog is taking dozens of kids from East Anchorage to high school, middle school, and elementary school. He greets every kid who walks onto the bus. Sometimes that comes with a safety reminder. Hey,
do me a favor, wait till the reds come out before you cross, because that car may or may not have stopped. Thanks. Yeah. Hi. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
He says the number of good mornings and hellos he gets back increases as the year goes on. That's one downside of the cohort system in place this fall, which gives every route 3 weeks of service and six without.
It takes just 3 weeks for them to get used to you, 3 to 4 weeks. So it's kind of a shame that 3 week break, it's kind of like right at that moment when the kids start feeling relaxed on the bus, they get to know you.
Herzog says this job isn't for everybody. You have to like kids and be patient with other drivers. You also have to be willing to work a split shift, a few hours for morning pickup and a few in the afternoon for drop-off. Herzog usually works around 30 hours a week. The district pays about $21 per hour. Herzog says one big incentive for him is access to health benefits. But he says some bus drivers say they can't make a living without a summer driving job.
When I first came on board, some people did say that their summer job allowed them to be the school bus driver.
A lot of those summer jobs are in the tourism industry. The district expects 17 drivers to return from summer jobs in mid-September. Yvette Edwards is a transportation supervisor for the district. She's also worked as a bus attendant and a driver.
A lot of our drivers stayed with the tourist company because they're making good tips, and people movers just as short, so they're pulling from bus drivers as well.
People Mover, the city's bus program, pays up to $29 hourly. One tour company, Alaska Cruise Transportation, lists pay at up to $27 an hour plus tips. Edwards says wages play a huge part in the driver shortage. And if the district wants to attract and retain drivers, she says, they should pay more. The district has been offering signing bonuses, paid training opportunities, and help getting new drivers their commercial driver's licenses. But according to Edwards, that's not why most applicants say they're applying.
There's a lot of outpour from the community. It's very touching because they're like, you know, I've heard the need and I just feel like I want to do my part. And I see you guys need people. And there's a lot of people that's why they're here.
Herzog has heard that from new drivers, too. New drivers ride along with him when they're getting familiar with the job. And he says a few of them have been parents in the district.
Three of them were just have kids in school, and they were like, I should help out.
Herzog's last stop for the morning is at Nunaka Valley Elementary School. Students thank him and say goodbye on their way out.
That should be everyone.
He'll be back later this afternoon, ready to greet each one of them with a smile. In Anchorage, I'm Katie Anastas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
It's been a big year for Tlingit Formline artist Jennifer Younger, and now it's gotten bigger and greener. Don't worry, we'll explain. Last winter, the Sitka-based carver and engraver created a t-shirt design for GNU, an indigenous-owned denim company based in Portland, Oregon. Younger was showcasing her work during London Fashion Week in February when she got word from GNU that Disney had come calling.
While I was in London, I received an email from GNU saying, hey, like there's a possibility they want to use some of our shirts in this new show. Of course, you know, they asked for my permission and I was very excited about that.
She said yes, but she didn't hear anything after that for several months. Then earlier this month, she was at the annual Santa Fe Indian Market and her phone started buzzing.
Fast forward to Santa Fe and I'm there and I get someone tagged me in a post on Facebook, like, you know, of show of the Hulk wearing the shirt.
Stretched across the Hulk's chest was her design, a formline raven. Younger, who is of the Eagle Moiety, says she's drawn to ravens in her designs. The shirt was featured in the show She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, on Disney's streaming service, Disney+. And in Sitka this July, Kiksati Clan House property was repatriated after nearly 20 years in the possession of another clan. Its new legal owner hopes the historic exchange will spur a greater conversation about repatriation. KCAW's Tosh Kimmel reports.
To the untrained eye, the overgrown vacant lot on Catlian Street may seem like just that. But to the Kiksati clan, it's a significant cultural site. This plot of land is where the Kiksati clan house known as the Point House once stood. Last month, after over 20 years outside of Kiksati possession, it's been repatriated to its home clan.
So the property was passed down in Western culture via a will. It was my understanding that the house was torn down maybe in the 80s or late 70s.
Jarek Hope Lang, a Juneau-based member of the Kiksati clan, now holds the deed. Although no longer physically standing, Hope Lang says the Point House still holds immense cultural significance.
Conceptually, we all know that we refer to our people as from the Point House. So the physical structure may not exist, but we as a people do. So the concept of the house being gone, that's just a physical structure.
In Tlingit tradition, property and clan affiliation are passed through the matrilineal line, unlike in Western culture where property is passed from both parents. Because marriage usually takes place between different clan members, to keep property within the hands of the rightful clan, it can't be passed down through the nuclear family. But in the case of the Point House, that's exactly what happened. Caught in the clash between Tlingit tradition and Western property law, it was passed down patrilineally, falling outside of Kiksati possession. But this isn't an isolated event. last year, another Klan house collapsed after years in bureaucratic limbo without a caretaker, spurring Hope Lang to act.
The Coho house fell down, and I just felt like it was like a real, like, it was like a now or never thing for me.
Over the course of a decade, Hope Lang developed a close friendship with one of the last two living heirs of the Point House, who declined to be interviewed for this story. They discussed an exchange before, but never followed through. In July, Hope Lang decided to ask again.
She had agreed at some point that she wanted to disperse her half of the property to me. I was excited, but also nervous. I was like, I'm going to Sitka. Do you want to come with me? And she said, I'd love to go. I said, well, let's have a conversation with the attorney over there and see what this process looks like.
From Juneau, they traveled to Sitka, where conveniently the other remaining heir was located. Hope Lang says he wasn't planning on signing anything that day, but as fate would have it, both remaining heirs agreed to sign the deed. And by the end of the day, he was the new legal owner of the property.
I was just kind of in shock because I just thought we were having a conversation.
Now, he plans to have the house rebuilt as a mixed-use gathering space. He hopes the revitalization of his Klan house will spark a broader conversation around repatriation.
Our Klan house revitalization could be more than this project. I think it starts here with this land back concept and how we identify that as individual clans beyond our tribes and how we move forward in that and act in that. I'm excited that future Kiksati children can walk into a place and say, this is my Klan house.
According to the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, there were once 43 standing Klan houses in Sitka's Indian Village District. Now only 9 remain.
They've been kind of coming down, slowly disappearing. And they've kind of been replaced with empty lots.
That's James Polson, a member of the Sitka Historic Preservation Commission. He says the proposed rebuilding of the Point House would not only be a cultural milestone, but a historical one.
It would be the first 21st century Klan house built in Sitka.
One of the few remaining Klan houses is the Porch House. Chuck Miller is its caretaker.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, come on in. We're in Kayashkahit. In Tlingit, it's translated as either the platform house or the porch house. Our family refers to it as the mother Coho house because it was the very first Coho clan house built.
Miller's clan house is one of the only functioning clan houses left in Sitka, and therefore acts as a cultural hub for other Coho clan members.
I mean, growing up for me here, I lived down the street literally, and I remember coming to this clan house when I was a very small young child, and having all my family here, family functions, meetings, food, etc.
Hope Lang wants to see the exact same thing for the Point House. For the Klan House to be rebuilt now, or at least in the lifetime of those generous enough to return it. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George and Wesley Early in Anchorage, and Catherine Rose and Tosh Kimmel in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.